This Week on Art on the Air features author Joyce Hicks with illustrator Melissa Washburn and their collaboration creating illustrations for Joyce's new novel. Next, large format photographic artist Michael Paul Cole discussing his unique artistic creations. Our spotlight is on Lebesnik Arts Center's 2022 Starry Night Gala on June 25th with Executive Director Janet Block.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's Breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Lebesnik Center for the Arts. Of course, we've heard her many times before, Janet Block. She's going to talk about some of the things coming up, exciting things both this month and in early July. Janet, welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you, Larry.
Aloha.
Thanks, Esther. Hi, Esther. Hi. How are you both?
You have an exciting thing, and you haven't been able to actually have it in person as much, but you got your gala coming out. So tell us all the details about that, and you have a special MC coming in.
Oh, sure. So Saturday, June 25th at 5:30, we will be back in person at Blue Chip Casino Hotel and Spa for our annual gala, which hasn't been so annual during COVID. It'll be our first time in live in 3 years. So we're super excited. And we have a great night planned. Our MC is Marianne Bergerson Ahern, who is well known for her work on NBC Channel 5 News Chicago. And she has emceed us for the live auction for, I think this is her third year. So, and it might even be her fourth, but we skipped a couple of years being virtual. So I'm not, but anyhow, she actually hails from Michigan City. She went to Marquette High School.
Oh,
so we're
my
super
gosh.
Excited. Yeah. So she brings with her people who come, and she's really enthusiastic about the arts. We also have a really cool DJ coming this year. Kind of tried to think a lot about what we really like for entertainment, and truthfully, people love to dance. And so we have DJ Glenn Russell, who is he was really well known in the 90s at establishments such as Neo and Exit, and he has a big following of people from kind of the 80s and 90s, industrial, but just an ear for great music. And so we're excited to have him DJ after the program. And we have
Janet, can you do a teaser on any of the auction items?
Oh my gosh, we honestly do have great auction items this year. We have, first of all, my own husband is a photographer, and he has a beautiful black and white photograph of Neil Peart from Rush. There's lots of Rush fans out there. And it's a really, and Neil Peart passed away, I think like 2 years ago. So, I talked him into donating that, but we also have lots of restaurant certificates, We have VIP tickets to the boat races in Michigan City. We have dance theater. We have both theater tickets, but we also have dance to Hubbard Street Theater, Field Museum. I'm trying to think of some of it. We have it's an Art Deco fireplace fan that is really gorgeous that somebody donated from their home. So yeah, I mean, we just have like some sort of odd.
So is there a virtual aspect to the auction as well? Or there is that only?
No, there is. You can attend. You can attend and bid on things, whether or not you attend the auction. Yep. Or the event. So that you can find on our website. It probably would be too long to repeat the link, and I don't know it offhand, but yes, you can make bids. It's not live yet, but it should be live in like another week. Perfect. It's not good to do it too early. So suspense.
So cost is $150 for individual, $1,500 for a table. Starts at 5:30. Not black tie, non-black tie, I guess you might say. So explain that.
We don't do that. We don't. We haven't. For a number of years,
probably been 10 years that it's been casual.
Yeah, no, we do it. One of the things people love about our gala is it is casual. You can dress artsy. So we're calling it Starry Night. So use your imagination, and you know, you might be wearing a Starry Night dress, or you might be wearing sequins and sparkles. We like people to be sort of artsy about how they dress, and it's summer and it's usually hot, and we want people to be comfortable. So you can literally wear shorts or you can wear a gown. We like the variety. And also, I just will tell you that for that $150, aside from all the fun, we do have an open bar, and we actually take we have a better quality bar. You know, and then we have a wonderful, elegant buffet that includes a carving prime rib and chicken breast and, you know, really what Blue Chip does their best. So, yeah, but most people will say it's just one of the more fun galas of, I will call it the most fun gala of the summer.
Well, that's great.
I can do that.
Well, it's coming up in July. You have a great exhibit coming up. And tell us a little bit about that in this about minute we have.
I do. I don't know if your viewers get this streaming, but I'm going to just say this is one piece that is a representation of, this is one of 72 pieces that will be in our installation room by a really well-known artist named Ebony Patterson, who has been in all the fairs. She is she hails from I believe it's Haiti, and the show is called Monique Meloche Presents. Monique Meloche is celebrating her 20th year as a Chicago gallery. And she championed in the very beginning and since artists of color. And most of her artists are now in museums across the world. So you are going to see some of those artists like Sanford Biggers, Ebony Patterson, Leo Bright, Jake Troilee. I mean,
did Monique curate?
Monique and Laura together curated. Yep, Monique and Laura together. Cherie Hovsepian is, I think she just won like a major award at the Venice Biennale. These are world-class artists, and Monique has a home in Miller Beach, so we're super excited to bring them.
Glad to have you back on the show again. Tell us about the gala and the exhibit coming up, that Starry Night on June 25th, and you get tickets at Lebesnik Center, and you get that online. Janet Block, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you always.
Thank you. Thank you, Janet.
And a quick Spotlight Extra. The Valpo Creative Council and DIY Art Studio have partnered to give away 270 DIY summer kits to kids thanks to our gracious sponsors. You can visit their booth at Valpo Art Fest on Saturday, June 25th or Sunday, June 26th to get a chance to take one of these all-inclusive creative kits home. You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
Larry and I would like to welcome Joyce Bird Hicks and Melissa Washburn to Art on the Air. Joyce is a keen observer of people, place, and time, which informs her writing. She writes about domestic life and the intricacies of marriage, particularly at gateways to new stages. Joyce grew up in upstate New York, and a career move brought her to Indiana. She has written three books: Unexpected Guests at Blackbird Lodge, which is set in the Adirondacks; Escape from Assisted Living, which features Chicago landmarks; and One More Foxtrot, a tale of second chances, set in Elkhart, Indiana. Melissa is an artist, illustrator, and graphic designer. She also grew up in upstate New York, but has lived in the Midwest since 1996. She creates expressive illustrations in both digital and traditional media. Very beautiful illustrations, by the way. As an avid hiker and birder, she is endlessly inspired by things that run, fly, and grow. Melissa has her own business called Melissa Washburn Illustration. Aloha, Joyce and Melissa. Welcome to Art on the Air.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Well, Joyce, we're going to start with you. We've had Melissa on before. In fact, she's been used to be the voice of Art on the Air for years ago. So anyway, we want to find out about kind of your history. And I always like to say where you grew up and everything, and like how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about yourself.
Well, as we just pointed out, I started out in upstate New York and always loved the mountains and hills of that area. But we moved to the Midwest, and after that, I just became thoroughly a Midwesterner, and I really love Chicago. So for my first two books, I didn't think too much about New York, and I thought about the Midwest and the values that seem to be pervasive here and the landmarks of Chicago that are so engaging. And so I set my first two books there, and then the Adirondacks just came back to me over and over again. And I decided to set a book there. But my journey to writing any books really didn't start until I was in my 50s. Up until then, I was helping student writers at Valparaiso University. And that just was very fulfilling. And I didn't seem to think I wanted to write any fiction. And then I started out with some short stories. And then finally one turned and seemed like a really good story. And I thought, I hate leaving these people behind. And so that turned into the family that I set in, not Valparaiso, but I set in Elkhart. The name of that town to me is very evocative for a fictional story. I don't know, kind of a clever name. And also Amtrak goes through there. So my character escaped her assisted living by getting on Amtrak and going to Chicago and finding a new life.
So Joyce, did you write for the school paper growing up? Did you, were you the writer in the class?
You know, that's funny. Yes, I think I didn't write for the paper or yearbook or anything, but I think I ran across a box full of old stuff that I had saved, and there were some school papers in there. And yeah, I think people turned to me like, well, let's see what Joyce wrote. that. And even when I looked at the stuff that I wrote in 10th and 11th grade, I could see that same tone that appears in the books of kind of humor and a slightly jaded view of what's going on and observational comments.
What were some of your inspirations of other writers over the time? And we kind of skipped around, you know, that's your school, we did college and things like that. But tell us a little about that and other writers that you may have gained inspiration or other inspirations.
Well, I went for undergraduate. I was a student at St. Lawrence University, which is in upstate New York, almost on the St. Lawrence River. And then my husband and I came to Michigan State, and really that was our move to the Midwest for him to go to graduate school and me to go to graduate school. But I think inspiration wise of looking at other writers, I think it was when I discovered Elizabeth Berg, a fiction writer who primarily writes fiction of interest to women, although that would be unfair to classify it entirely that way. But her view on life and the kinds of things that she wrote about, I thought I could write about those things. Those are things I'm interested in writing about. And so, you know, I've read all of her books. And then more recently, Stuart Onan has some books about older people. And again, his view and care and detail and ability to explore something small really is what I like to do.
You know, I gained a lot. I gained inspiration by going through your, I read one of your blogs and you quoted Jeanette Leardi about create something, maintain something, repair something, or let go of something, which really is, it was like, it's such a great guideline for just about any discipline, I think. Do you apply that? Because everybody goes through, all creative people go through, I believe at least, ebbs and flows of inspiration and, you know, day to day. And just like reading that, it was just like, wow, there's a clear guideline for the next step. So did you, so do you follow that? Like when you hit that place where, what is the next step in my book or where is this going?
Yeah, I have trouble letting go something. I'm always thinking, okay, this has got to go somewhere. What happened to this character next? But that's true. You do have to be able to step back.
Oh, yeah. The culling of, you mean, are you talking about characters in your books and stuff? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
So how did you and Melissa meet and come to collaborate on this? Because and I'll just jump ahead real quick and just say, you know, the cover, I'm just like, boy, what a good choice you made in Melissa, because I would take a look at that book solely based on walking by that cover. It is so gorgeous.
You want to hear that, right? do you want to take that, Melissa?
Sure. I got an email from Joyce back at the beginning of the year. We have a mutual friend acquaintance who's also an illustrator who happens to be Joyce's neighbor. And this mutual friend recommended me for the job. And I don't work with self-published authors a whole lot. And we can get into, you know, how that all works and why later. But, you know, when Joyce told me about the book and the subject matter and the fact that it was set in upstate New York, not far from where I grew up, I was like, well, I need to find out more. And we talked and she had, you know, very realistic expectations about my role in the process. And it felt good. You know, it was like my gut said, yeah, this is one to take. So we had a couple conversations and shared a Pinterest board to kind of look at inspiration. And it was clear that she wanted my work for the cover, which was definitely a green light for working on this project. So, yeah.
Can you tell us about that process of exchange there? I mean, a little bit more detail, like how you obviously had to read the book, but then, you know, you're back and forth a little bit. That, I think that'd be enlightening to our audience.
Well, Larry, you said obviously had to read the book. That is the key, in that if you hire an illustrator through, all kinds of companies that offer to do that, they often don't read the book. They have you fill in a number of questions. And in those questions, you strive to convey the tone. And my first experience with that for the first book through CreateSpace, although they were great to work with, the illustrator sent back something that would have been on the front of your Blue Cross Blue Shield introductory brochure, because I said it was about someone, you know, escape from assisted living. So you think, you know, so, okay, another call there and you get into difficulty because they may offer to only show you two versions. And so someone who hasn't read the book would make that assumption. So when Melissa said she was willing to read the book, that made it a go.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really important because there were things that we put into the cover design that, you know, a casual observer walking by the book is not going to understand all the references, but there's a lot of little Easter eggs in there, things that represent the characters, the setting, events that happen in the book. And, you know, there's no way to get that intricacy if you haven't read it. And I will say, I don't read a ton of literary fiction. I'm more of a, I'm usually either reading like sci-fi and speculative fiction, or I'm reading natural history. But, you know, a few authors that that I do really love that do some literary fiction would be like Margaret Atwood and A.S. Byatt. And I've read some Richard Russo. That's my claim to fame. My hometown in upstate New York is where Richard Russo is from. And it's weird reading his books because there are just these, even the way the characters talk, it's like, oh, that's like, that's where I grew up. It just evokes the place so much. So I think that between me being from this place that Joyce was writing about and reading and really enjoying these characters, it helped shape how I looked at what we incorporated into the design. So,
and I think we're both interested in regionalism in terms of that part of the country. It's funny you mentioned Russo because that's the other one I would have mentioned. And absolutely, his characters have come from not your hometown but my hometown. They've been so familiar. So we were both interested in that region, I think, and so it really contributed to her choices. Because, for example, you could ask an illustrator to say, well, it's called Blackbird Lodge, and you know, we all have a vision of lodge, and the lodge of the Adirondack Mountains is very different from the ski lodge that you might encounter in.
Can you describe it? Because as I was reading, I would love to hear more about the region and your experiences with it and some of the history.
Do you want?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the lodges up in that part of the Adirondacks are quite old. They date from, you know, the 20s and 30s. Would you say, Joyce?
Pre-1900
even. Okay, so some of them are sort of log cabin architecture, but quite fancy because these were homes built by wealthy people. There's outbuildings. A lot of them are on or near lakes. There's a lot of sort of intricate, what would you call it? Like lattice work, but out of branches as opposed to flat, kind of milled pieces. And it is really unique to that area.
Yeah, the great camps were built by the railroad magnates and other industrialists. So they would send their family up there for the summer. And my personal experience was the camp built by the Huntington family at the turn of the century. And they were railroad people. They had their own railroad that went to their camp. The idea that the family would be up there all summer by the 20s had kind of died out. But these places were very elaborate. And at Huntington, they even imported Swiss chalets so that everything would look, you know, rustic and mountainous. But there's a lot of history, and they have been the subject of many books. If you read speculative fiction, there's some set there. And you know, with strange happenings and ghosts and all sorts of things.
So what Joyce, what is your most memorable memory from that time?
Well, I suppose something that doesn't come to play in the book is we were sent up there as campers in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade from the campus school from the state of New York. Each of the teachers' colleges had campus schools. So those of us that went to the campus school, because our college trained recreation majors, they sent all the middle schoolers up there for weeks at a time. And we were allowed to do stuff that today they would never allow kids to do. There would be, you know, threats of lawsuits, what they're going to sleep in the snow. They let them go out in canoes. They, you know, all the things, wonderful things we did, but a lot of it was also the storytelling that went on. The old codgers that would be the camp manager and the cook who'd been there forever. They had stories of the old days and the ghosts and all of that kind of thing really, you know, caught my imagination. And just the past there is, it's all wonderfully preserved, of course, by the state of New York with the Adirondack Park. So you can't just go and build a little subdivision of cottages any old place in the Adirondacks. It's all protected.
Yeah, the Adirondack Park is a pretty special place. I believe it's the largest state park in the continental U.S.
That's true.
A lot of it was owned by International Paper, so even though it was used in that way, it's been very... it's been protected from development over the years, and the park has taken over more and more land. But yeah, my grandparents had a camp up on one of the lakes when I was a kid, and we would go up there and go, you know, fishing and hiking and all of that. And it's Boy Scout and Girl Scout camps in the southern part of the Adirondacks too, that I spent time, my brother and I spent time at as kids. And, you know, old hunting camps, and just, yeah, the stories are just amazing. My father had a whole library of books about the Adirondacks, and it was all this, you know, Adirondack lore and everything from birds to campfire stories to stuff like that. So it definitely hits that nostalgia button for me big time.
Quite magical.
So Joyce, I'm interested in your writing process. So tell us a little bit about that, like how it goes from maybe an idea or characters into, you know, your product.
Well, I think I find that usually in the first chapter or two, and in the case of the first book, it began with a short story. But in this book, I find that I get interested in characters, and I may fill the first two chapters with too much detail or too many characters that I start to get engaged with. I remember I always belonged to writing groups where you read things, and one guy in the group said, "So, are you just going to keep inventing characters for this book, or is there something that's ever really going to happen?" So I think that's where I start, is to come up with some characters that have little quirks that you can then rely on to develop. Like in this, one of the characters in Blackbird is a writer who was a Wonder Boy kind of novelist. His first novel came out when he was in his late 20s, and he was just hot stuff and traveled the country doing readings, and he was very charismatic. But his books that came out after that did not strike the same note. And so he has always felt that the next one is going to be that work that, you know, establishes him in it. So I just thought of not exactly people I know, but or knew, but the things that often go along with the artistic temperament, you know, an egotistical view or great talent and abilities in one area, but lacking in another.
That's so interesting, because then how, so does the name come first or does the character? So now this adds a very interesting element, yeah. About the naming of these characters.
Yeah. Well, in fact, in this case, the main character had an unpronounceable Eastern European sort of last name that was all full of consonants. And so his agent urged him to get a new name that was more, would look better on the cover of a book, and that would allow people to be able to type it into Google and get it right. So I don't know. I think I get the people first, and then I work on their names, because I changed the main character's name several times. The woman's name went through a lot of iterations.
Does it sometimes, like how it sounds to your ear, even your character names?
Yeah, and does it imply the right sorts of things? And I had thought of some names that sounded really cute, and I thought, I think her first time around name was Gina, just because, I don't know, I thought that sounded really nice, and I wanted to dress Gina and all of that. But as the book went along, I thought, Gina has nothing to do with her wanting to be a writer and having, you know, gotten an MFA and having some things published. Gina did not convey that. I needed a literary sounding name. So finally I switched to Charlotte, which comes burdened with, you know, implications. And
you know, real quick, and Melissa's been on the show before, but I want you to briefly share what you do for anyone that hasn't actually heard you before, or what you do. You know, we only have about a few minutes left here, but tell us a little bit about you and your illustration.
Sure. So I'll give you the short version, which is just sort of what I'm doing now. I'm a full-time illustrator and designer, and I work with everyone from licensing companies. Like I've licensed work for calendars and greeting cards, and create my own products, fabric, stationery, things like that, and do commissions for things like magazines and book covers, obviously. And just did some posters for Indiana Audubon. So my work is all very, very based in nature. That's sort of my inspiration. That's when people need something that's about plants or birds or insects or things in that related to that space, they come to me. And I love every minute of it. I left a full-time job about 10 years ago to do illustration freelance, and it's been a great journey.
And you have a line of coloring books too about nature.
The books I've published with Quarry Books are not actually coloring books, they're drawing instruction books.
Okay.
But yeah, there's one on plants, one on animals, and one on birds and insects. They're available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, bookshop.org, all those kinds of places.
Well, while we still have you, why don't you tell us your contact information, and then we'll do the same with Joyce.
Okay, you can find me online at melissawashburn.com, and everything you would need to know is there.
Okay. And Joyce, we have just a little over a minute left, and I know you don't have any social media, but tell us about how people can find your books, find out more about you, and everything.
Well, my granddaughter that visited is a commission to help me get on, do something with Instagram. But my website is joycebhicks.com, and there's email contacts from there. And pretty soon, all three books will be, well, the first two are available on Amazon, and this third book will be available on Amazon as well as Ingram. And in independent bookstores.
Very good. Well, we appreciate you both coming on Art in the Air. I'm Melissa Washburn, illustrator for Joyce Hicks' new book, available on Amazon. You can find out both information. We'll also have links on our webpage. And when we do our Facebook connection, you can connect with them there. We appreciate you coming on Art on the Air. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you both.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Michael Paul Cole to Art on the Air. Michael's photography touches on the senses. I first experienced his work more than a dozen years ago, and the images are still vivid. The dusky faded colors, curling paper, rusty nails, the architectural salvage for the frames, the sense of time past, all achieved in the darkroom and studio table. Larry and I would like to thank you, Michael, for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha, Michael. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad I'm able to talk to you guys.
Well, we're so happy to have you on board here. Well, what people in our audience want to know is a little bit about you, your whole origin story and everything, like I always like to say, how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about how you got here.
Well, I was born and raised and grew up in the Seattle area on Northwest in a small town called Sumner, just outside of Tacoma. And it was kind of a place where they the town's industries was growing berries and flowers. And I lived out there, and I have I was just kind of always interested in the nature and the being outdoors. And I, at a very young age, took up a camera. I think of my first photographs were when in 1969. So I think I was probably around 10 years old at that time.
What camera did you use at that time?
Oh, it was a little Brownie. I think my grandmother gave it to me. I went out to Michigan to visit her. My family originally was from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. And I went out there, and I think my grandfather and my grandmother gave me the camera. And I started just photographing the trees and all that. And it was the same. It was right at the same time the landing of the moon was happening. So I was fascinated with the moon. I was trying to photograph the moon, but this little Brownie couldn't do it. And remember just trying every which way to get a nice photograph of the moon, but and no prevail. But it actually interested in photography.
So, Michael, was there a photography program in high school?
Not really. There was. I had a teacher in a mass media class called in Sumner. His name was Walter Barbie, and he was just this great guy who saw that I was interested in photography, and he just handed me the keys to the darkroom and gave me a few lessons and says, go for it. And so I had use of the darkroom in the high school for the entire time I was there. And I really wasn't in a class, but I was able to just do my photographs.
Were they nature or architectural?
Mostly nature at the time. I was really interested in doing just black and white. And I would hike and travel and take photographs. And where I lived, there was always a lot of there's a lot of places to go out in nature. Also, it was kind of a blue collar area. And right at the bottom of the hill was a slaughterhouse. And for some reason, I got really interested in photographing, not them producing the animals, but just the patina of the entire building and everything. It was also a little mom and pop place. And so I spent a lot of time just wandering out around the old barn and photographing and collecting things and stuff like that. It was kind of a part of it too, but most of the time I was just out in the woods making photographs.
So were you tinting? Was that part of your high school experience as well, tinting the photographs?
Oh no, that happened later on. That went on for quite a few years, and then there was a point where I thought, oh, I need to go get a real job. So I started higher education, and it was in engineering. And I thought I was going to become a chemical engineer. And but it was during like the Reagan administration. There was no work. Things were really slow. So I ended up going to work at a photo lab just as a printer, and realized how much I love photographs and still taking photographs. And so I just started that back up, and the next thing I know, I'm doing it full time. So
tell me about your equipment journey, because I know where we're going to end up here, but you started out with your Brownie. What was your next camera and the next camera and next camera in film, I know. So tell us a little bit about the different tools you use and cameras.
Well, you know, I had the Brownie, and then I started getting really interested right in college. So I went out and bought myself an old Spotmatic Pentax. I remember having that for a short time. And I was making these photographs, and this friend of mine, who is an older gentleman who I kept on showing the photographs to, and he says, you know, I think you need this. And he hands me this Bronica SQA. It was this really old medium format camera, and it was massive, and it used Nikkor lenses, and it was like a professional camera, but it was like loud and a lot of parts are moving, and it was this kind of the only way to describe it, it was kind of steampunk. Like, and I used that for a few years and I really loved it. But then somebody showed me a 4x5 and I got into that, and the next thing I know, I'm using that. And so most of the time in my photographing career, I've been using medium format and large format. Occasionally I would use 35, but that was if I was traveling abroad. And sometimes I would take the Hasselblad, and then later on I got Hasselblads and started using those. But when I'm home, I was using 4x5.
Have you ever ventured into digital, or as you've stayed with film and basically large format film from this point on?
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is so many times I've tried, you know, and even friends have given me really good cameras to use. Like, I have this great Canon digital camera here, but I have never used it. I just have no interest in picking it up and photographing with it. It's just something about it. It's just not me. I mean, I'm not knocking digital photographs. They're amazing, but it's just, I just can't seem to get into the whole idea of using it. So they just sit around here and collect dust, pretty much.
Well, I mean, digital photography has revolutionized so much, but I always try to explain to some people how film photography will always exist, much like sailboating will always exist next to powerboating. I mean, it's a different way, and it will, I think, always will exist. And of course, anything when you're using large format, like you are, and all the way up to even some people that are using 8x10 film, there's still something about that that's so much more forgiving in terms of photography.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. And also, too, a thing I've realized is when film photography was the commercial way of making imagery, there was a certain, I guess it was, there was a certain way things were done. Because of the commercialism of the film and the photography and Nikon and Kodak and all that, they basically were saying this is the way to make art photography. And so everybody seemed to do it basically the same way. Since now it's like just a niche, no one's looking at it that way. I see these young people coming up with some great imagery that is their own voice. And it's no commercialism is basically telling them how to make a piece of art out of it. And so it's really kind of interesting how it's changed since the commercialism of film photography is gone. They have no interest in it in that way. And so it's become this, I guess you would say it's kind of reinvented itself.
Yeah, it's kind of like in audio how vinyl discs have come back also and everything, kind of a throwback. And, of course, you have your process is a whole lot different because, you know, you're using chemicals and the whole post-processing, and I know you print on silver. Do you do anything in color at all? I mean, is it all black and white or black and white and tinted?
Yeah, it's black and white tinted. Even when color film was available, I never shot it. I literally would never shoot color film. It was always black and white. I mean, it was kind of comical. I would go out to, I lived in Seattle, and I would go out to the flower fields and these magnificent colors in the tulips and the daffodils blooming around where I lived. And I would photograph everything in black and white.
So tell us a little bit about your process. You whatever you pick as a subject from beginning to end. So you pick a subject, but then we know there's more to your photography than just the actual print. There's a whole different rendering and the framing and everything like that. But just tell us that whole process.
Well, when I take I use film. It's mostly like Tri-X or HP5. I make the image onto film. After that, I developed the image. I tried to develop the image in a way that gives it a little bit of more contrast. I just kind of like the look. And then I make a print, which is on silver gelatin photographic paper, fiber base. And so I print the image, and if I need to stain or bleach the image in the dark room, I can do that. But that's kind of arbitrary to whatever is happening with that moment. And I always print to eye. I don't print to any kind of standards. I just whatever looks good to me at that moment. And sometimes they change quite drastically, I have to say. And then after they are printed, and I dry them, and then I figure out which ones I like. I trim them, and then I stain them with tar. I use a solution of turpentine, linseed oil, and tar to give a certain staining and amber look to the image. And then if it needs to be colorized, I use a translucent oil and pigments to make the images have a little bit of color to them. And also I use straight turpentine to wash the images sometimes to give certain glow to it if it needs to be reduced from the staining of the tar. So they kind of, and the whole idea of using the tar comes from when I was in my 20s, it was, I met this gentleman, a friend of a friend, who was a photographer, and he lived in Brazil. And he was this older gentleman, and he told me all about how they would use tar to tone their images. And I thought it was really fascinating. And it took me years to figure out exactly what they were doing there, but I kind of came up with my own rendition of it. I don't know if it's exactly what he did, but it's what I've been doing since. And it's just, it's kind of a toning process, I would, if I was just to describe it.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Well, then, yeah, that's your final presentation is now you have the print. You do something that's very unique in terms of your presentation. Tell us about how you select the pieces to go into that, the framing, the mounting, everything like that, because that's I think, what really makes your work stand out.
Yeah, all the trips you must take just to find all the pieces for the framing.
Yeah, it's been a progression. Originally, I think my inspiration was when I was a kid, there was this old farmer down the street. His name was Mr. Nix, and he had this old barn in behind his house. And in the barn was literally hundreds of specimen boxes. And they were like insects and things like that. And what they were the collection of his brother who had passed away years earlier, and he was an entomologist. And these were all these beautiful cherry wood specimen boxes with all these insects in them. And I would spend hours in that little barn looking at all these insects. And so I think one of my inspirations was to start making images like that. So I started making these pieces where I would make the photograph look like a specimen. I would use these nails to hold it in place. And I would actually build the boxes originally out of cherry wood. And they had that look. They kind of looked like specimen boxes. And then over the years, I just kind of started adding things to them. And I started finding found objects that I thought were really amazing that would go good with these images. And I just kind of, it just kind of evolved into this, you know, these shrines, basically. You know, they're just like, you know, I love the patina and the aging of things. So I use that as part of these frames that I make around it. And I'm looking for things that you know have a certain match to the image. And sometimes I'll make a frame and I go, I know what I'm going to put in this. Or sometimes I make an image and I go, I need to make a frame to fit this image. So it goes back and forth. It's like the chicken and the egg thing. But it's been a progression. I mean, I've been working on that kind of idea for probably 15 years now.
Yeah, well, they're so memorable and so gorgeous. I mean, they're just vividly implanted in my mind from that first time I saw them, probably, you know, 12 to 15 years ago.
And you know, they're very much a whole piece of art in and of themselves. besides the photograph. The photograph is a part of the whole total presentation. I'm looking at some of the things right now on your website, and I think one at Magic City Art Connection, and there's just such a construction to the whole piece. And like I said, you have some things where it looks like a butterfly specimen box, and even though it's a photograph, it's really interesting. Something we've been asking all of our guests is how COVID impacted you, the whole pandemic. Did it become a creative period for you? Was it a shutdown? So tell us about how that impacted you.
Well, it was, it obviously impacted me just as much as, you know, everybody out there. But, you know, I was out doing art festivals in Florida, and I started hearing, you know, the rumors that things were getting worse and worse, and I decided to come home. And literally the day I got to my house from Florida up in Hannibal, everything just got shut down. And I literally was like going, okay, what am I going to do until this is over with? Like everybody was doing. And it gave me some time to just kind of think about things and work on projects. And, you know, it was kind of funny. The thing about when I'm home, when I'm on the road, I'm doing the art shows and I'm exploring and, you know, doing my thing. But when I'm home, I'm usually just in I live in an old 10,000 square foot warehouse, and it's my studio and it's where I live and stuff. So once I'm in here, I'm like, you know, I don't leave. it's just what I do. And so it's kind of like, once I got here, it was, you know, here I am. I'm hunkered down. And so for the next almost a year, I was kind of like, just like everybody else, like doing art. And
so did it lead you to experiment, or where is your mind taking you now? What is going to be, I think I read that you're going to maybe blend some digital with what you're doing, or so where is it that you want to explore?
So funny. I actually did. I was thinking about, I kind of rethought about everything I did. You know, I was kind of like, I verbalized everything more clearly to myself. But one thing I started, I go, you know, I need to look at digital. So I spent like 3-4 months, like, setting up, you know, a printer, and I was trying to figure out how I was going to do it, and all this. And at the end of about 3 or 4 months, I'm like going, I'm just not interested. You know, so I just stopped. But I did come up with a really good digital negative to do platinum and tallow type photographs. So it wasn't totally a loss of time, but I've done some alternative processes with digital negatives now. And I do like that look. I like the way they're turning out. So that's been good. So, outside of that, you know, it's mostly just making work the way I always did and going out and photographing. And I have a friend that had a farm outside of town, and I spent quite a bit of time just wandering around there taking photographs and things like that. So, you know, it was good. It was good time. I mean, I really actually, you know, outside of the stress of, you know, how you're going to make a living and get on with life. But it was good in its own way, you know.
And you're still racking up all those awards at the shows already. So,
yeah, I still make a certain amount of awards, which is always I'm grateful about. And it's
well
really,
deserved.
Yeah, and I really appreciate the response I have to my work and how it's, you know, people just really love it. And that is part of the motivation, too, of keep on making it.
It really is like finding a secret trove, and it's very haunting. You know, I just, like, the images are sort of always in that peripheral in my mind. You know, they're just really so beautiful.
We have just about a minute left, so we want to find out how people can find out about you and anything you're looking forward to doing that you haven't done.
Well, I'm you can find me on michaelpaulcole.com or Photographic Works by Michael Paul Cole on Facebook is pretty much what I have going on right now. And there is different ways to contact me. And usually most people just get a hold of me and just ask me what I have around. And I'll start sending them images. Most of them, my pieces are one of a kind. And they go live other places pretty quickly. So it's mostly just, you know, what I got going on right then. And, you know, I show people. And if you're in Hannibal, come by the old warehouse. People do that, too. It's I'll show them around and show what I got going on at that moment.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. That's Michael Paul Cole, more than just a photographer, but like a photographic artist who, beyond the photography, puts these wonderful works together from dragonfly, garage beetle type things to everything, just beautifully rendered pieces on there. So thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air.
Thank you, Michael, so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Art in the Air, and we'd like to thank our guests this week on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art in the Air is heard every Friday at 11 a.m. and rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP. Art in the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at LakeshorePublicRadio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP station manager, and Tom Maloney, vice president of radio operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. Underwriters for Art in the Air, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments, and Mary LeVan, Arts Patron. Art in the Air is always looking for financial support. We'd like to thank our current supporters. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, Esther and I especially would invite you to become an underwriter of this program in particular. We have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA. You can find out support information there. So don't just be an Art on the Air listener. Become a supporter or underwriter in whatever amount you're able to do so we continue to bring you this great content and this great local programming. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. And you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.